The following program is being broadcast on the Amazing Women of Power, the world's leading positive programming network, powered by Raven International. This show contains motivational language and may not be suitable for negative listeners.
Schemes. I'll choose my friends because apparently they're choosing me. The time is now to pay attention to my destiny.
From his humble studio in Orange County, California, comes a young songwriter with a dream, encouraging others to go after their dreams. Learning from the best in the business and passing it along to you, it's Strongwriter on the radio.
I had the blues, but I made it better, baby. And that's why I wrote this song. And now you can sing along.
Yeah. My mind's made up to inspire you and hopefully touch your life through the lives of some very good friends of mine. My name is Dean Olson. Welcome to Strongwriter on the Radio, helping songwriters stay musically fit. And the way I like to do that is through faith and encouragement. And you're certainly going to get that here. I love talking to artists and songwriters about their music, and it's double the pleasure when it is two people, a husband and wife duo, two lives joined as one in matrimony and music. I want you to meet a couple of my very good friends, Michael Trotter Jr. and Tanya Blunt Trotter, known to many of their loyal fans now as The War and Treaty. That's what they call themselves, and it's been kind of an evolution to get to that name. They went through a few. And here's just a little bit of an intro on what they're doing right now. They live and tour in the Baltimore area as well as globally. And recently, their music has culminated in an album titled The War and Treaty, live at Blue House Studios. It's Americana, it's soul, it's country, and it's just good stuff. This will be a multi-episode event. We're going to first go back in time to 2012 when I first met Michael Trotter Jr. And back then, he was going under the pen name or stage name of Mike Ivory. And we don't really go into that. As a matter of fact, we don't even have an intro. We're just going to go right into talking, and I'll catch you on the other side.
How do you like people to refer to you as a singer, songwriter, as a or as a performer or president of your own company? Or what is it that you like to be known for?
I'm president of my own company. I am a singer and a songwriter, and, you know, however they are able to word that is fine with me. I think it's important for people to know, first and foremost, that I do own my own record label, and that's very important in our industry, you know, and secondly, then I am an artist who is also a songwriter as well.
So. Yeah. You've been singing since the age of three. That's kind of young. Who put you out there to do that?
Well, you know, I come from a church background, and being, you know, a part of a family that is very spiritual, you know, you get your first kind of groundwork in the church, being able to sing in front of people. And my uncle, Zelbert, he put me on the organ with him at three and pushed me to sing once he realized that I had a gift. So I had my moments of crying, and I didn't want to do it even during the performance. And they have that kind of he has it kind of on tape somewhere. But eventually, you know, my grandmother, rest her soul, she was heard in the crowd saying, "It's okay, baby, sing." And that gave me what I needed, and I went on ahead, and I haven't stopped singing since.
So you have memories of that being that young, and you know, it was.
You know, I've been gifted with a very strong memory bank. I remember even younger. I would say maybe 2 years old, as far as I can go back. And it's moments that I remember. Like one moment, my aunt was, my uncle was getting married, and I was supposed to hold the train as my aunt walked down the aisle. And I remember when those doors opened, how it felt for everyone to be staring at me. And I turned around. I hightailed out of there, man, and ran straight to the arms of my mother. And I wasn't able to walk her down the aisle holding her train. So this is moments that I capitalized on, and I somehow burned into my memory bank, and I have not forgotten.
That's great. That's great stuff. Do you? How old are you right now? I'm trying to figure out how far back this is.
Right, I'm currently 30 years old.
Okay, 30. A lot of experience under your belt then, at least 27 years worth of singing. And did you carry this on through school, and did you enter competitions or just perform?
I did. My first competition I entered was in 1996 here in Washington, D.C., and it was called the Future Fest Singing Competition, hosted by the mayor at the time, Mayor Barry.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area. And I took first place in this competition and went on to complete. I took first place in my own sector, which would be my district.
Uh-huh.
And I was then afforded to go and compete regionally. And it wasn't a national competition, but what it did was it gained national exposure. The final competition was held at the historic Lincoln Theater.
Oh, good.
And I took first place there. And one of the things that sparked my songwriting, and this is for all the songwriters that you come in contact with, a lot of people, they need something that would spark an interest for them to put their feelings in a journal. And this was one of those moments, because when they announced who won third place, you know, a guy by the name of Jeffrey, and he stood up, and his family, almost half the audience, you know, they stood up and they cheered and they were screaming for him. And then a young man by the name of Osito, he took second place.
Uh-huh.
As well, and the same thing happened for him. He had a wealth of support there, and everyone, you know, was cheering and they were saluting him. And he thought he had won, so he was very disappointed, you know. And to his travail, I believed him to be the winner as well, because his skill, in my opinion, far outweighed mine. But I was the only artist that sang without music, without accompaniment.
Oh.
And I did everything a cappella. And I sang an old Negro spiritual called Ain't That Good News.
Oh, that's a wonderful song. Yeah. To do it a cappella, too, huh?
Oh, yes. And it's a beautiful rendition, that a cappella style. But what stood out for me that day, well, my victory was kind of overshadowed by my lack of support. I wanted to get the award and run away with a check and just run off the stage. But as you know, when you win those type of competitions and they present the big check, those are photo ops.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to stay on the stage, and I just knew that they were going to ask that question that I dreaded. You know, where's your support? Who's here for you? Where's your mom? Where's your dad? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what they did not know was at that moment I was living in a homeless shelter for battered women with my mom.
Oh, my goodness.
Called the House of Ruth. And I had two younger siblings, so my mother was not able to be present. So I had one person there, which was a teacher. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, a guidance counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I remember. I remember no one standing up, no one clapping, and no one cheering for me. You know, and as a young gent who's gone through enough already, I'm the oldest of three. I've seen so much and heard so much. It was something that I did not want to ever experience again.
Mm-hmm.
It was very dramatic. And although I should have been the happiest kid on earth that day, I became almost the most embarrassed child you could have ever met. But what gave me hope was to be able to go home and show my mom that I had indeed won. I won. You know, the kid from Cleveland, Ohio, who no one expected to win, I won. And to give her this check for $1,000, and in the 90s, $1,000 was not a dollar like it is today. I mean, $1,000 comes and goes, but in the 90s, for a impoverished family, a $1,000 that you just gained, it's something that is like, woohoo!
Yeah.
it's it's something to dance to. So wow. That's what actually sparked my interest in writing, because I had a lot of emotions, as you could imagine, and I had a lot of feelings, and I didn't know how to do anything except sing.
Right.
And so I wrote the words down, and it wasn't enough for me to read those words. I wanted melody to it. I wanted it to be dark. I love classical music, and I loved how the strings would fight. I love how the violin competes against the oboe at times, and I love how, you know, the trumpet and the tubas and how hidden the bassoon can be inside of an orchestrated piece. I wanted all that emotion to emulate what was inside of me, and I wanted lyrics to respond, you know, and that's what writing is to me. When you write a song, it's different for me because I hear melody first. And so my lyrics simply respond to the melody that I hear. And a lot of people, they write backwards. And some writers, a lot of writers, they can't write melody. They just write lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you get into the theory of something or the science of a thing, you would remember as a child, in order for you to even learn ABCs, you had to kind of be able to put it together with the melody. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And it helps the child to be able to retain. Even if you listen to some of our commercials, some of the commercials, have you had your break today? You didn't purposely set out to remember that commercial.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, what happens is the melody is what your mind automatically connects to. That's why even with some songs, you don't know the lyrics, but you know the melody, and you'll mumble a little bit over the lyrics, especially if you've ever listened to a Busta Rhymes song.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how I get in tune with what's going on. I hear sound first, and if I put a tune to that sound, that's when it becomes a melody. And I'm able to then formulate an opinion on that melody. And all my lyrics are just a simple opinion as to whatever subject I derive from what I hear. So that's how the writing began for me.
I was sinking deep in sin. I couldn't find peace down within. But my God stepped on in. I was stuck in a world of pain. I couldn't see sunlight for the rain, but our God stole the pain. Some people say the best things are free, but that ain't my testimony. Others, they say good things come to those who wait, and I'm so glad I waited for you to see me through. I almost went down the wrong way, but you wouldn't let death have its way. So glad that when others exposed my worst, you were there revealing my worth.
So just to recap, you get a sound in your head, you almost create a mood. Once you get it out, you know, get it on tape or whatever, then you go from there and start writing the lyrics from that mood that you might have set.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And lyrics for me, it just happens, you know, and it derives from conversations I've already had,
mm-hmm.
you know, or experiences I've already gone through. In fact, Dean, it took me a long time to be able to write for an artist that was not me.
Mm-hmm.
I tried it one time, and the artist frustrated me so much because they could not emote the song the way I could.
Ah, okay.
One song I had was called Golden Days, and I believe he couldn't connect because he had never been in love or seen love from days of old. If you think about it, being in love today is a lot different than it was when you were in love yesterday, because being in love yesterday was real love.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents and walking around town and taking two straws and sipping it out of a glass bottle of Coca-Cola. That's real love.
That's genuine, yeah.
You know, but today, love is fast. That love took time. So I called it golden days. He wanted to speed through the song. You know, even his delivery, somewhere in another life. You know, and they do all the runs and riffs, and that's cool. But this song took time because you're making love all over again. You know, and so I found it hard to write for people because I didn't want to go through that again. I didn't want to write a song and you could not emote the song or respect it the way I respect it. But what I had to learn was that people relate in different ways. So my advice to writers would be, when you're writing for someone, remember they have their own story and they react differently. That's what makes us all special.
Right. Now, do you feel that sometimes you put on a producer hat, even though you may not know that you have those kind of skills? Do you sort of direct the artist that you're trying to emote, like you just said?
You have to.
Do you sometimes have to collaborate in a way to get inside their head and see if they can reach down and find their own emotion?
Most definitely. That's how hits are made, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember listening to my favorite artist, Johnny Cash.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to the Man in Black speak about his moments of right songwriting, and how when he and Elvis Jerry Lee Lewis, when they all got together in the studio one day and, you know, they started writing the song that one of them had wrote, singing a song that one had wrote and recording it, and you could hear Jerry Lee Lewis in the back, "No, it's not done like that."
Yeah. Even in the early days of recording, it was always like that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the good fight, you know, get each other stronger. Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Have you experienced that yourself in some way?
You know, I definitely have. In writing with an artist, you know, not being able to sometimes see eye to eye, it even creates even more of a great contrast in a song, because you see it one way, the artist sees it another way. But you have to be able to come to some sort of simple agreement that both ways are correct, just figuring out how it can be presented is where the dilemma comes in, you know. So,
yeah. Okay, I'll tell you what, let me back up a little bit. So you were in you pretty much grew up in Cleveland, is that true?
Yeah, I'm a mutt.
Oh.
So I kind of have split roots. All the way up until 1996, resided in Cleveland, Ohio, and then from 96 till about, actually 2000,
mm-hmm.
I reigned in Washington, D.C., and then between D.C. and Maryland, and then 2000, I kind of went back home to Cleveland
mm-hmm.
for a little while, and I came back in 2001, and I've been here since.
The first time you were in D.C., is that when you were with your mom in the shelter for all those times? Okay.
Yes, the first time, my first experience was at the House of Roof Homeless Shelter for Battered Women. And yeah. I learned so much about the culture of D.C. and what it represents and what it had to offer as a young African-American male.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned a lot and what it meant to be able to see someone of a different race, you know, up close and personal, because in Cleveland, you don't have that. You're not afforded that as much. You stay on your side of the town.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those things where I had my first encounter with a Caucasian male here in D.C. So I'm thankful for that, you know, because I had formulated my own opinion as to, you know, the different sides of the fence. But D.C. taught me that it is not that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
And, yeah.
And that, in fact, to me, you know, I'll say this, and I'll go on record saying this. I believe the most beautiful sound in the world is a choir that is multicultural.
That does sound good, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. There's such a purity behind it, man. It's I don't ever have to go to a physical heaven. If you could just sit me down in front of a choir that has multiple cultures involved, that's heaven for me on earth, man. That's enough. You know.
What I always like about that, when you do have a multicultural thing, when you have Asians, you have whites, you have blacks, you have Latin performers all on the stage together, which I've seen, And each voice isn't stereotypically what you think it might sound like. You know, the white people might have more soul than the, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just the dynamics. You just never know what you're going to get when it comes out.
Yeah. I like to say Robin Thicke stole my voice.
Robin Thicke. Now, you know, when you were talking about, I really appreciate the story you just told about your mom back in, you know, in D.C. in the early years. I almost got a lump in my throat. That's the kind of stuff that I believe if it touches just one person that listens to this or reads this, they're going to get some inspiration from that, because they know that, you know, you can move on, right? You can move on from, and you didn't have that support, as you said, right in the beginning. How soon before you got the ball rolling, or you got your feet moving, so to speak, on getting a career going?
To be honest with you, it took a while, because after that, I kind of stunted my musical career a little bit. I had several opportunities fall by the wayside, and I'm not ashamed to talk about my early years, because it's my foundation. You know, I came from a home. Well, let's just start from here. Maybe a week later, after I presented my mom with that check, I ended up learning that we were to move back with my father.
Uh-huh.
And he was going to move up in D.C., and we would link up and move with him. And I couldn't understand that, because we were here because of him. You know,
right.
We were in that shelter for battered women because she was a battered woman. You know, no ands, ifs, or buts about it. Now, out of that $1,000, I saw $75.
Wow.
In the form of a pair of Dennis Rodman worms, sneakers. So I had a hard time seeing how it could help my life, you know, because here it is. Yeah, it brought me that quick money.
Uh-huh.
But then it brought back one of the most painful experiences of my life.
Oh, yeah. I talked to an artist who was a battered woman herself, you know, and she tried to, I don't know, be the bigger person and not paint her husband as the villain in this picture. I mean, have you come to terms with that, with your father?
Oh, most definitely. In fact, there were several things that had to happen, which allowed me to be able to talk in this manner, because he doesn't hide anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't hide anything in regards to his own personal struggles. But in the interest of music, he helped build who I am today.
Right.
You know, I wrote a lot of my songs based on what I saw him going through and little things like that. So for me, musically, I took that break all the way up until about 2003, when I joined the United States Army. And music was the last thing on my mind. What was on my mind was being able to provide for my child, my oldest girl, which is Michaela. And I tell you what, the military career is a very promising career for a lot of young men who are either troubled or directionless. They have no clue what they're going to do with their lives. And I am a supporter of the military, I will say that. However, I am not too thrilled as to what takes place with people who leave the military who do not have good experiences. I have probably had one of the worst military careers ever thought to man.
Uh-oh.
I received my honorable discharge, and again, I will say it is honorable,
uh-huh.
discharge in 2007, but I joined in 2003. Why was my career so short? Well, I'll let you know. Those years, from 2003 to 2007, that's 4 years, I spent approximately 2.5 years at war in Iraq,
uh-huh.
and the rest training for the war in Iraq. So I almost lost my mind, and I had no clue what to do. I guess I'll just sing again. I guess I'll sing even while I'm at war. Man, I guess I'll channel my energy into writing songs that would take the troops' mind off of war.
Perfect. That's what I was hoping.
Well, I tell you what, Dana, you might want to catch this. This is very important. Out of all the places in Iraq I could have been stationed, I was sent to Baghdad, Iraq.
Mm.
And we stayed inside of Uday's castle. That's one of Saddam's sons.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you what. Here's what's so cool about that. It was the castle after war. So you could tell how much rubble and soot and brick was laying around. And we stayed there. But at the bottom of the, of the FOB, and that's in military terms, that's Forward Operating Base. at the bottom of that base, inside of one of the buildings, guess what?
Listen.
There was a baby grand piano.
Oh, boy. This sounds good already, but how did that happen?
Brother, I have no, to this day, there was no explanation as to why, out of all the places in Iraq, that piano was there. And I remember speaking to my first sergeant. I said, you know, there's a piano downstairs. He said, yep. And he's like, you know, they use it for, they would use it for chapel, but there's nobody on the base that can play it. And guess what, Dean? I'll tell you the truth. Not even me. I did not know how to play the piano.
Not even then you didn't, huh?
No. So you know what I did? I spent my time learning in Iraq.
How'd you, who taught you? Did you teach yourself this? Did you know somebody over there on the base, or?
Nope. I taught myself. I one-fingered it until I was able to be skilled enough to hear two notes, and then I started hearing and remembering what I heard in orchestra and symphonies that I had attended.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio stations I listened to, and different musical chords and songs like Thriller that has kind of a great composition of Michael Jackson and Prince, and you know, anything that would spark Madonna, anything that would spark movement, I wanted to play it on the piano. And man, before I knew it, within a matter of maybe 2 months, I was able to successfully play chords and start playing for the chapel service.
Oh, good man.
And I was playing so well that the chaplain ordered a keyboard in case we would need to move. And that we did. We ended up leaving that base, and I ended up going to an even more remote area, which was considered Fallujah, Iraq. And that was the hot zone.
Yes,
and
it was.
But I had my keyboard. And you know what? Anybody who was there with me say, at any given evening, you can catch Trotter outside with the troops in a safe location. And uh-huh. He's singing and playing, and he's sparking rappers to write. Rap artists are writing songs off of what I'm playing. You know, aspiring rappers in the army. And people are now coming out with guitars. And we're just having a good old time. Soldiers are calling home, please send me a keyboard. Please send me a guitar. To no success, but the hopes were just so high. And we were taking their minds off. And then one of the guys died. And now I'm given a chance to be able to sing for the troops in honor of this soldier. And I sang, and I wrote a song called Stairway to Heaven for this guy. He was a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And in the military, it is not lawful during times of war to show too much emotion. You can't really cry or anything like that. But there wasn't a dry eye in the house, man. It was such an amazing service, and a moment of sorrow turned into a moment of joy based on the song. The general gave me his coin, and he wanted me to do that for as many soldiers as I possibly could, and that's what I did. So my secondary job became the memorial singer.
How has faith played a role in all these different experiences you've had, both in the Army and you know, hard times with your mother, etc.? Has it always been strong through all that?
I would say it's been tested through all of that.
Right.
Because there's moments where my faith was very weak. And there have been moments where my faith it was very strong. But through it all, it has been tested in a way that you can't even imagine. But I kept my eyes on the skyscraper. That's what I call above. I call it skyscraper.
Now, that sounds like a good reference to a song. And that's one of the ones I checked out. That's a good song that you did there, Skyscraper. It sounded like you had a lot of emotion behind that.
I really did.
She said I'll never be nothing. Oh, she said I ain't got what it takes. It's the fat man with fat chance, but I don't mind eating my piece of cake. I know I got a lot to prove, so baby, this one's for you. Oh, I know I gotta lose some weight, so I'm starting with you. No more lies, no tearing me down. You was a queen, but I revoked your crown. On this journey uphill now, your laughter taught me not to give up now. Eyes on the prize of Cleveland, do it for my homies, can't leave them. Oh,
you know, a lot of people ask me, well, what do you mean by skyscrapers? If you think of any fixture or building or skyscraper, you know, it's so beautiful. I mean, the Twin Towers, what they're doing now is so gorgeous, and the White House and the monuments and the Eiffel Tower, any main attraction in our world that's a fixture is gorgeous. But if people would take time to think about what it took to make that sculpture, there's a lot of dirt and mud involved and burning and banging and smashing and stomping, you know, and nailing involved. It's not a pretty process.
Right.
But the end result is outstanding. It's magnificent. So I encourage my listeners to keep your eye on the skyscraper. And that's you. Essentially, you are the skyscraper. But if you need something above to look at, you know, keep your eyes on those skyscrapers. And, you know, I would say that it's been quite rewarding to be able to put out music that is directly reflecting your story. You know, my second competition I won was a competition called The Military Idol.
Okay.
And I tell you, you're getting all the scoop. But
you bet I am. I do appreciate that a lot. Thank you.
The Military Idol in Europe, I competed and I took first place. And I was then afforded the opportunity to come to the United States to perform and compete for Military Idol. And one of the judges just happened to be Miss Deborah Bird. She was the vocal coach for American Idol, as well as the great Mr. Michael Peterson.
Okay.
And, you know, once I got there and you get weighed in, you know, and in the Military Idol, you have to weigh a certain weight. You can't be overweight because you're representing the United States military. And the United States military is not overweight. It's very fit, clean cut, mm-hmm. and it's strong.
Yeah, lean and mean, as they say.
Yeah, right. So I was all of the above except one. I was overweight for my age group, and I was not allowed to continue in the competition. And the bittersweet moment was this. They allowed me to sing for the actual show, but I was not to go forward. And it was quite hurtful for Deborah Bird as well as Michael because
okay.
I was one of the ones who they just said, he's going to win. In fact, I received no negative remarks. And once again, I sang a song a cappella. But I'm told I'm not going to win. And I know this. I know that if I sing, know that whatever you do, it's not going to be judged. So I had the choice that I was going to go on the show and just sing, be whimsical about it, you know, not care. Or was I going to go out here and give it my all, even knowing that nothing will happen for me. Even knowing that the television recording of this, I would not be seen.
Yeah.
And knowing that I have to go back to Germany and face my area, Europe, as a loser. And not even as a loser because I had no talent, but a loser because you're fat.
Wow.
Yeah. That hits you. You have a choice that you have to make, and I had to make that choice. And my choice was, at that moment, but somebody could hear me. No, not someone could recognize me. Someone could hear what I have to say and change their mind. Some troop might hear my voice and decide he doesn't want to commit suicide. You know, and now those are the moments, like we started in this conversation, I tell you, I remember events. I remember moments. And that was another moment, Dean, where bittersweet. And it seems like my entire life in relation to music has been bittersweet.
That's kind of what life is, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Doggone it, man. I could stop the interview right there, but I got to hear more, Mike. Is that okay?
Hey, I'm no problem at all.
All right. And so endeth part one of this War and Treaty special. Many thanks to Michael Trotter Jr., otherwise known as Mike Ivory. And we are going to see you next week with part two. I got to get going. Please put your best pen forward and let's all be strong writers together. My name is Dean Olson for Strong Writer on the radio. Take care and have a great weekend. Goodbye now.
You've been listening to Strong Rider on the Radio with your host, Dean Olson, on the Amazing Women and Men of Power, world's leading positive programming network powered by Raven International.